You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sessue Hayakawa is probably best known for his Oscar-nominated role in The Bridge on the River Kwai in 1957, but he'd already had a distinguished career during the movie's silent era when he appeared in over 60 films. Daisuke Miao describes the actor's remarkable rise in his new book called Sessue Hayakawa, Silent Cinema and Transnational Stardom. It's published by Duke University Press. Ms. Miao, who is assistant professor of Japanese literature and film at the University of Oregon, will be introducing a number of the Hayakawa films tonight and tomorrow night at the Museum of Modern Art as part of a retrospective of the actor's work, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
Wasn't Hayakawa going to become a naval officer in Japan? What ended that?
Yeah, that was his dream. But because of a sea accident, he had to give up his dream, and he came to the United States instead.
But it must have hit him pretty hard. He even tried to commit suicide before he decided to.
Exactly.
So I guess the United States was better than killing himself.
At that time, yes.
And how did he become an actor?
Well, it was like accidental. He came to the United States to study political economy at the University of Chicago. And on his way back home, he started acting in some Japanese-American theaters in Los Angeles. And Thomas Ince, a Japanese film producer, I mean, the producer of Japanese subject films in Los Angeles, he hired Hayakawa as an extra of his films.
And Hayakawa distinguished himself by having a very natural acting style at a time when everybody was overacting.
Right, right. Natural, but very intense. I'm calling this intense ambiguity or ambiguous intensity, Hayakawa's acting. So it's not really restrained or, silent kind of acting. It's exaggerated at the same time. So it's a mixture of restrained.
Well, how did that intensity come across?
Maybe his eyes and his mouth. And they are so intense, strong.
And he started his film career on the same week as Charlie Chaplin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody remembers Charlie Chaplin. Only a few people remember Sessue Hayakawa, either silent film buffs or people who remember him from The Bridge on the River Kwai. What happened? Did they have parallel careers for a while?
Well, actually, Hayakawa was as big as Chaplin in 1916, 1917. Some advertisement on newspapers in Detroit, they actually juxtaposed Hayakawa, Chaplin, and Bill S. Hart, William S. Hart, Western actor, star. So he was as big as Chaplin at Hart in 1916.
But he was playing mostly predators and villains, wasn't he?
Not really. He also played very romantic heroes, too.
But this was a time of strong anti-Asian attitudes.
Exactly.
In the United States, especially against the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Was
in Japanese.
The Japanese as well?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So why was he able to have a career at a time when Hollywood's racial attitudes had curtailed so many other actors, Asian actors' careers?
That was the most curious, element in Hayakawa's stardom. It's a strange time. I mean, there was an anti-Japanese movement in California, but at the same time, there was a huge fascination to Japanese culture among Americans in the same period, Japanese taste, which is called. So Hayakawa mixed, this fear and fascination towards Japan in the 19-teens, 1920s.
Well, Japan was going through a major period of transition at this time. We're talking about the late teens, the early 20s, when Japan is going in from the Meiji period into the military-controlled government that led to World War II.
Yes. So Hayakawa's career was a very complicated one, too. He started out as an American star, but in Japan, he was considered to be the representative of a Japanese man. So he was kind of,
So he was Toshiro Mifune and an American star as well?
So to speak, yes.
He wasn't always cast as Japanese or even Asian. the Mexican bandit. He was a Hawaiian prince, an American Indian, an Arab donkey tender, an Indian rebel leader. Anything that was slightly dark skinned.
White. Yes, exactly.
He didn't have to worry about accent because he was in silent films.
Yes.
Did that mean that he also could play in European films? Because so many European stars would come here, mm-hmm. and they could play American, even
right.
though they had heavy Hungarian accents.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He actually played Spanish in one of his films called The Brand of Lopez. The print is not available any longer, so we can't see him as a Spanish, though.
Why do you think he became such a star? Is it because he was so good-looking?
I think so. I mean, you know, he's a good-looking guy. But at the same time, his acting capability, skill, strong eyes.
And even when he was playing a villain, he had a way of making his characters sympathetic.
Exactly. That was his strategy of, you know, Paramount Pictures. I mean, at that time, it was called Lasky Pictures. Try to make him heroic, at the same time, villainous, sympathetic, but threatening, ambivalent. Very ambivalent.
Oh, that complicated man is always attractive.
Yes.
But wasn't there also pressure on him to Americanize his image?
Definitely. When he established his own production company in 1918, he didn't name that production company Hayakawa Pictures, but Hayworth Pictures. I think it's a mixture of Hayakawa's H-A plus his director, Bill Worthington's Worth, so Hayworth Pictures.
And what kinds of films did he produce? Was he trying to correct the image about Asians in this country?
At the beginning, he said he would like to make films about true Japanese characters. But eventually, you know, he knew, you know, what would attract American audience. So he went back to play orientalistic roles.
The complicated, exactly. Slightly villainous. But he did make this movie called The Dragon Painter, mm-hmm. which was his attempt to give a more accurate portrayal of Japanese culture in this country. Did that film do well in the United States?
I think so. It was very well received. But I have to say, even though it's about Japan, the film was shot in Yosemite. So it's a very exotic type of Japan.
Yosemite. Is there any place that looks like Yosemite in Japan?
As far as I know, there aren't any. Of course, there are many exotic locations in Japan, but I don't think so.
My guest is Daisuke Miyao, M-I-Y-A-O. His biography of Setsuo Hayakawa, Silent Cinema and Transnational Stardom, is published by Duke University Press. You're introducing some of Hayakawa's earliest films tonight, Omimi-san and The Wrath of the Gods, and then later in the evening, The Cheat. These are all short films? Were they one and two reelers?
Omimi-san is like 20 minutes, but the other two, it's about an hour. Mm-hmm. So they are considered to be the feature-length films.
And his co-star in Omimi-san was Aoki, who he would marry, and Mildred Harris, who would soon marry Charlie Chaplin.
Yes, exactly.
Do these movies reveal the kinds of roles that Hayakawa would play throughout his career?
Omimi-san is his debut film, and The Wrath of the Gods, it's his first feature-length film. But he was a supporting role in The Wrath of the Gods.
The Cheat is described as his breakthrough
film. The Cheat
is
the most famous and notorious Hayakawa film.
Why?
Hayakawa played a very villainous, awfully sexy villain in that film.
An art dealer.
Yes.
But the director is Cecil B. DeMille.
Exactly.
So is this considered one of Cecil B. DeMille's important films?
Yeah, in the teens, yes. He made lots of, you know, luxurious films in the 19-teens with Gloria Swanson. So I think this is one of his first attempts to make these luxurious films of the middle-class culture.
And he also worked with Hayakawa. But how did Hayakawa feel about playing these villains? Actors often love playing villains because they're the meatier roles, and it's fun making a villain into a human. Mm-hmm. Did he see it that way, or did he see himself as being used in a stereotypical way?
Well, he was a little bit, you know, irritated by these stereotypical depictions of Japanese people. But at the same time, he liked to play villains. The one film that he always mentioned was called The Jaguar's Claw, in which he played a Mexican bandit that you mentioned. It was a very villainous and sexy role. So I think, you know, Hayakawa loved to play villains too.
And the sexy is important because crossing those racial barriers at that time was a major taboo. And so there's a certain, I guess, certain excitement in the imagining that he might. I think it took a long time before a Japanese actor actually kissed a non-Japanese, a white woman in a film. I think that we may have to go all the way to Sam Fuller or somebody like that for that to happen.
Exactly. In the case of Hayakawa, I'm calling this the no-kiss policy. Even though Hayakawa has a girlfriend played by Caucasian actresses, they don't kiss at all.
Then came the sound films. Now, he could have played, I'm sure he spoke English quite well. Mm-hmm. And we know from The Bridge on the River Kwai that he had a very good voice. What happened? Why didn't he make the transition?
He actually went to Europe during the war. So it was a little bit too late for him to come back to the United States.
Well, he'd gone to Japan, and then he went to France. But he lived in France during the German occupation and the war. That doesn't sound like the best place to be.
No, I don't think so.
Was he trapped there, or was he, as a Japanese man, seen as a friend to the Vichy government and to the Nazi occupiers?
Well, he was not really welcome in Japan in the 1920s when he went back to Japan. He was too Americanized, and the United States was an enemy country, so to speak. So he was a sort of an exile in France.
And then he came back after the war?
Well, actually, he went to the United States instead of going back to Japan. thanks to Humphrey Bogart. He was a big fan of Hayakawa, and he invited Hayakawa to appear in his film, Tokyo Joe, another villain, sexy villain.
Well, and from then on, anytime there was a World War II film, I'm sure he was considered as one of the possible players of some awful Japanese military guy.
Yeah, but at the same time, they are sympathetic too. A film, Claudette Colbert film, Three Came Home. Hayakawa played a villainous Japanese
officer. So did he work continuously up to the time that he played Colonel Saito in The Bridge on the River Kwai?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did.
But that film revived his career, and yet he never had much after that.
He appeared in several films in the United States and in Japan, but not as successful as The Kwai.
And when did he die?
When he was 73, I think.
Now, he was in a number of really successful films. Do you have any idea why he is largely forgotten today? Think with changing racial attitudes and with the revived career of Anna May Wong and some other Asians who also worked in Hollywood during that time,
right,
that Hayakawa would have been revived as well.
I hope so. I mean, you know, from
that's your job to do with this series.
Yeah, but many of the silent stars are forgotten.
Are these films worthwhile, or are they only interesting as films that show us what Hollywood attitudes toward Asians and Mexicans and whatever else were at the time?
Definitely.
These are not great films?
Yeah. please come and see to watch these films at the MoMA. And
is there anyone that I really should see?
The most famous and notorious one is The Cheat.
And that's tonight.
Which will be, played tonight.
Cecil B. DeMille. If not for Sesshi Hayakawa, who is worth the price of admission, well then, for early Cecil B. DeMille. And my great thanks to Daisuke Miao, who is an assistant professor of Japanese literature and film at the University of Oregon and author of Sesshi Hayakawa, Silent Cinema and Transnational Stardom, published by Duke University Press.
Thank you very much.
By the way, if you want to know more about what's happening tonight at the Museum of Modern Art, You can check out our show page at WNYC.org for all the information. Up next, Ian Ayers describes how data crunchers can be more accurate than the experts' predictions and why doing the math can give us new insight into banking, baseball, even online dating. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite.